Hello there. Today is Monday, October the 7th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, even with word of a second whistleblower, Trump allies stand behind him.
I just don't think that's what the president was really saying.
U.S. and North Korea stall even as they just get started. Also ahead, a celebrity's father talks about his battle with breast cancer and the stigma of men getting the rare disease. It's all on today's International Edition. The disclosure of a second whistleblower threatens to undermine arguments made by President Donald Trump and his allies that a whistleblower complaint was improperly filed because it was largely based on secondhand information. Attorney Mark Zaid told the Associated Press in a text message Sunday that the second whistleblower, who also works in intelligence, has spoken to the intelligence community's internal watchdog. This person has not filed a complaint but does have firsthand knowledge of supported the original whistleblower. In an interview with ABC's This Week, Democratic Congressman Hakeem Jeffries says the issues driving the impeachment inquiry are hiding in plain sight.
The president's own words in the public domain have indicated that he doesn't think there's any problem with soliciting foreign interference. The whistleblower complaint has been corroborated by information in the public domain every step of the way.
But Trump ally, also speaking on ABC's This Week, Republican Congressman Jim Jordan says, when asked if it was okay for President Trump to ask foreign leaders like China to investigate a political rival, he said the president shouldn't be taken literally.
I don't think anyone in America really believes, except people maybe in the press and some Democrats in Congress, really believe that the president of the United States thinks China is going to investigate. He's making a statement.
Trump has rejected the accusations that he did anything improper. The original whistleblower, a CIA officer, filed a formal complaint with the inspector general on August 12th that triggered the impeachment inquiry led by House Democrats. The complaint alleged Trump used the power of his office to solicit interference from a foreign country for the 2020 election. Joining us to discuss all of it is Jeremy Mayer, associate professor at the Schar School of Policy and Government at George Mason University. Jeremy, how precedented is this whole situation?
If you had imagined any previous president soliciting assistance with dirt on a potential political opponent, it is inconceivable. And yet, because of the polarized nature of our politics right now, most Republicans in Washington and most Republicans around the country are still solidly behind this president as of this moment. And
I know there's a political aspect to this, and that's why they're probably all silent. But these are people running for an office to serve the people and uphold the Constitution. So how will they convince people that they will be doing that? What happened to upholding the Constitution? Politics is one thing, but when things start to get to the point where it's so out in the open like that,
the Republicans are still able to tell themselves and to tell the media that the conduct they've observed does not yet rise to the level of an impeachable offense. There was one guy on the Intel committee when they were hearing from the DNI. He said, "I don't like what's in the transcript. It's bad, but..." And then he proceeded to attack the Democrats for exaggerating the seriousness of it. So at this heavily polarized moment, Republicans in Congress are tolerating conduct that no previous conduct would have tolerated in the president of either party. Several times now, Republicans like Mark Sanford, Republicans like Jeff Flake challenged this president directly, and they are both out of Congress. One was defeated in a primary. The other left politics because he knew he would get in a primary. And so those lessons teach congressional Republicans that until a significant portion and maybe a majority of the Republican base has serious doubts about this president, they are not going to abandon him, regardless of what he does.
The president is under an impeachment inquiry. That does not mean he's getting impeached, right? So what exactly does that all mean and what will happen likely?
So the House majority, the Democrats under Nancy Pelosi, now believes that they have no choice but to impeach the president. Some of them have wanted to impeach him for a long time, which is one of the Republican talking points. Some Democrats have considered him to be corrupt from almost day one, either from the refusal to disclose his taxes, refusal to fully investigate the Russia matter and his own businesses. He's not given them up, as prior presidents have. So there were always Democrats wanting this. The reason it's happened now is that the conduct in the Ukraine situation was so blatant that moderate Democrats, who'd been the one holding Pelosi back, said, yeah, this is national security, this is foreign policy, this is worse.
Why is this so bad for foreign policy?
Well, it suggests that the foreign policy of the United States is now in service to the personal and political needs of the president and of the president, the man, Donald Trump, rather than the needs of the nation. And that's a foundational shift. But it's one of many in this presidency. Let's take another example, human rights. Donald Trump is doing less to support human rights rhetorically and in terms of his policies than any modern president. It used to be that one of the mantles the American president wore was leader of the free world. That was a vision of America as leader of an alliance, first against the Soviet Union and then kind of against anarchy itself. It was always about human rights. And this president made it clear when the Saudi Arabian regime killed and chopped up an American resident journalist inside an embassy in Turkey, that his priority was weapon sales to Saudi Arabia, and that despite our own intel community telling him at a very high level of certainty that the crown prince of Saudi Arabia ordered it, Trump has ignored that. So it's one thing to say we're going to balance human rights with other concerns. It's another just to really forget about human rights entirely.
And then there's the whole issue of the whistleblower. We're hearing that the president's public attacks on this unidentified person are complicating negotiations for the whistleblower to testify to Congress for concern that testifying would raise the person's risk of exposure. How concerned
right. So
would that be?
We have had whistleblowers in the past in other presidencies, and no president has ever suggested publicly that actions be taken or that this person deserves to be shot or is a spy or is a treacherous person. And it makes you wonder about the emotional stability of the president. Is he up to this job? I mean, part of being president in the modern era is being attacked in sometimes the most outrageous ways. And let's not forget, Barack Obama had his legitimacy questioned almost from the moment he was elected by people who doubted whether he was a native-born American. And one of the people that was fueling that racist conspiracy theory was Donald J. Trump. And yet throughout that brutal assault on his legitimacy, Barack Obama never lashed out and showed anger. In fact, he showed humor about it. I'm sure he did not like it. But this president is a different man. He can't stand it. And so he lashes out in these emotional and childish ways that are unprecedented in American history.
All right, Jeremy Mayer. He is associate professor at the Schar School of Policy and Government at George Mason University. Thank you for being with us. Here are some of the stories we're following at voanews.com. Greece has transferred 570 migrants from an overcrowded camp. The death toll from the Iraqi protests has now risen to over 100. Portugal's ruling socialists win election, but without an outright majority. And an African first, Madagascar caviar tickles taste buds in France. Find expanded coverage of these stories and more at voanews.com. and on our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition. North Korea has angrily walked away from working-level nuclear talks with the United States. Pyongyang's top negotiator said he was greatly disappointed with Washington's inflexible approach, as VOA's Bill Gallo reports from Seoul.
The first substantive nuclear negotiations in months between North Korea and the U.S. broke down after just one day in Stockholm, Sweden. North Korea's top nuclear envoy, Kim Myung-gil, says the talks failed because the U.S. would not abandon its old approach. The U.S. quickly disputed that characterization, saying the 8.5-hour talks went good and that the U.S. brought creative ideas. The breakdown raises the possibility North Korea will intensify its provocations days after testing a new medium-range ballistic missile. But the North's decision could also amount to a negotiating tactic meant to raise pressure on Washington. U.S. President Donald Trump appeared to use a similar tactic this February in Vietnam, when he abruptly walked away from a summit with North Korean leader Kim Jong-un. After that summit, both sides quickly said they would eventually like to resume diplomacy, but neither has indicated they will substantially change their negotiating stance. U.S. officials say they accepted a Swedish invitation to return to the talks in 2 weeks. It's not clear whether North Korea will show up. Bill Gallo, VOA News, Seoul.
The Hong Kong government Friday banned people from wearing masks at public protests by invoking a British colonial-era emergency regulations ordinance that was last used to quell riots in 1967. VOA's Brian Padden reports the controversial anti-mask law is strongly supported by pro-Beijing elements in the legislature that view the increasingly violent democracy protests as a threat to law and order, while opponents see the measure as a way to deter peaceful dissent.
Hong Kong's chief executive, Carrie Lam, said on Friday the new anti-mask law that will take effect on Saturday is intended to target rioters and those that resort to violence.
The objective of this regulation is to end violence and restore order. And I believe this is now the broad consensus of Hong Kong people.
For the last 4 months, the city has been engulfed in unrest as democracy advocates engaged in increasingly confrontational tactics to fight against what they see as China's efforts to restrict Hong Kong's autonomy and civil liberties. Hong Kong government supporters defend the restrictive emergency measure as a need to protect public safety.
What we are talking about is pinpointing riot and illegal assembly. So what we think that is the law will not affect the daily life of people and will not affect the freedom of speech and freedom of demonstration for Hong Kong citizens.
In central Hong Kong on Friday, thousands of pro-democracy demonstrators responded in defiance of the new law by wearing masks during a lunchtime rally. Some protesters have attacked police and destroyed property. Police, in turn, have used water cannons, tear gas, and rubber bullets against the demonstrators. This week, for the first time, a police officer shot an 18-year-old student using lethal ammunition during a massive protest on China's Communist Party anniversary. Opponents of the anti-mask law say the measure will not deter radical elements in the democracy movement. Instead, they say the anti-mask law is meant to expose peaceful protesters to intimidation and repercussions from China-affiliated employers.
But they have a good reason that they don't want to be retaliated or singled out by the Chinese investor behind their company.
Hong Kong legislators who have not been allowed to vote on the measure say this use of emergency powers erodes Hong Kong's democracy.
This is a further draconian step, attempt to restrict the freedoms and rights of the Hong Kong people, damage to the rule of law, and there will be no legislative scrutiny at all. So I think that this is a dangerous step.
Lam also said if the unrest continues, the Hong Kong government could consider further emergency measures. Brian Padden, VOA News, Hong Kong.
And you're listening to International Edition, back in 1 minute.
Voices. We're talking about the news and issues you're talking about.
Sharing stories of development and growth across Africa, around the world, and in our lives. Topics that inform, empower,
and change the rules.
It's time for Our Voices
with me, Heidi Adams Fitzpatrick.
And Hadiza Kiari.
And Ayan Bior.
And Orion Itangi Shaka.
Join us on Facebook at VOA Our Voices.
It's time for Our Voices.
Hi, I'm Nikki Strong. You love music? How about Blake Shelton and Carrie Underwood? Or Merle Haggard and Loretta Lynn? Experience the best in country music on Country Hits USA. I bring you some country rock, outlaw, a little hillbilly, contemporary, and more, with a dash of entertainment news, too. So join me for Country Hits USA on VOA 1, the voice of America.
VOA's International Edition continues. Getting a full 8 hours of sleep just isn't in the cards for some people, but what about a quick nap? Well, new research suggests short naps can lower a person's risk for cardiovascular events like heart attacks and strokes by as much as 48%. Karina Bafra-Josian visited a new shop that believes in the value of a good nap.
Over a third of Americans, about 35%, don't get enough sleep, according to a new study by the U.S. Center of Disease Control and Prevention. But the Recharge PowerNap studio in D.C. is trying to solve that problem.
What really a PowerNap is that in between states, between being awake and between being asleep, where your brainwave activity is lower, and that's what helps you rest. It's not necessarily that you fall asleep. It's just being in that restful space, you know, that makes you feel better after, more productive, more energized.
The idea of a short power nap, not longer than half an hour, was developed in the 1990s by U.S. psychologist James Moss. His research suggested napping doesn't necessarily mean falling asleep, as long as other conditions are present, dim lights, cool temperatures, and quiet.
I'm nicer to people when I come, and if I don't come for like a week or two, I can definitely tell that my mood changes back to stressed out.
Well, I've always really loved meditating and relaxation, but right now I have a 5-month-old at home, and so this is my chance in the middle of the workday to get a little bit extra sleep, a little bit more relaxation.
More and more companies are buying into the idea of power naps. Special sleep capsules are installed at corporations like Google and Amazon, yet full-on nap studios remain a rarity. But sleep and meditation researchers believe this concept will soon win hearts and minds the world over.
I think that as we move forward, we will be focusing more as a society, as in America, on providing spaces for health, wellness, rest, relaxation, and providing a space for some little naps during your day.
The Power Nap Studio has been open for over 3 years now, and the price for a 20-minute nap session costs $9. But for the people who use it, it's a small price to pay for good health, a quick recharge, and a brighter outlook. Karina Befredjian for VOA News, Washington, D.C.
October is Breast Cancer Awareness Month, and while mostly women are afflicted by the disease, there are risks to some men as well. Music executive and the father of Beyoncé Knowles has recently come forward publicly to announce he is battling stage 1A breast cancer. In an interview with Good Morning America, Matthew Knowles explains how he found it and the stigma attached to the diagnosis for a man.
I told my wife, and she says, you know what? I saw a dot of blood on the sheets. So I immediately went to my doctor. I got a mammogram, and then it was very clear that I had breast cancer. Why would I get this? From a man's perspective, I'm thinking, why me? So I have that BRCA2 that's mutated, which means I have four things to be concerned about. Prostate cancer, pancreatic cancer, melanoma, and breast cancer. The rest of my life, I have to be very much aware and conscious and do all of the early detection, constant mammograms, constant prostate exams, constant MRI for the rest of my life. Well, I had my surgery the last week of July, and now I'm doing all the steps for recovery. I stopped drinking. I wanted to just have a clean bill of health, do things, exercise, meditate, just look at the world differently. I learned again that the numbers we have for men on breast cancer are not adequate because we don't have enough men that come forward that take the exam. I'm hoping by me coming here today, speaking out, letting folks know that you can survive this. But it has to be early detection, and I can't overemphasize the word early.
And Noel says that while men may feel embarrassed and keep it hidden, it's important for them to find support from healthcare professionals who understand the needs of men as well as women who are diagnosed with breast cancer. Drummer Ginger Baker, the volatile British musician who was best known for his time with the power trio Cream, has died at the age of 80. Margie Sarzaletta reports.
Ginger Baker was explosive in more ways than one. He considered himself a jazz drummer, but many a rock drummer was influenced by Baker's combination of aggression and precision. His drum solos were legendary, and he's often referred to as the first superstar drummer. Cream sold 10 million records with songs like Strange Brew, White Room, and Sunshine of Your Love. Then there was his personality. Baker and Cream singer-bassist Jack Bruce actively hated each other. A 2012 documentary, Beware of Mr. Baker, was named for the sign outside Baker's house in South Africa. I'm Archie Zaralletta.
An organization that helps music professionals who need financial, personal, or medical assistance will be honoring Aerosmith as its 2020 Person of the Year. Music Cares announced Friday that it will recognize the four-time Grammy-winning band for its philanthropic efforts and for its impact on American music over five decades. The group has programs that include addiction recovery, senior housing, leadership activities, and more. Aerosmith will be honored on January 24th, two nights before the 62nd Annual Grammy Awards in Los Angeles. Last year's recipient was Dolly Parton. Fleetwood Mac was the first group to win the award in 2018. Aerosmith is celebrating 50 years together and is performing at the Park MGM in Las Vegas until next year. You've been listening to International Edition. That does it for our show today, but you can find us anytime at voanews.com. Thank you for joining us, and thanks to our director, Tracy Carter, and our engineer, Jimmy Cook. I'm Lori London in Washington. Have a great day.
Want to relax, unwind, or charge up? Then listen to Music Time in Africa this weekend. It'll do all that for you and more. I'm Heather Maxwell. I know good music. And Africa is my passion. Join me every Saturday and Sunday for 1 hour of commercial-free Pan-African music of the highest caliber. You get great music, music news, and amazing artist interviews from rising stars to superstars. This listen will take you places. So do it. Join me for Music Time in Africa, your weekend destination.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The corrupt, illegitimate regime of Nicolas Maduro has decimated the people and economy of Venezuela, once the most affluent country in Latin America. But it's not too late. Venezuela can still turn around and again be free, democratic, and prosperous. The goal of restoring democracy and prosperity in Venezuela has driven the Trump administration's policy in Latin America from the beginning. However, this goal cannot be achieved under the illegitimate regime of Nicolas Maduro, which continues to abuse the Venezuelan people, manipulate well-intentioned diplomatic processes, and maneuver humanitarian aid for its own benefit, even as it appropriates Venezuela's resources to maintain its hold on power, said U.S. Department of State Deputy Assistant Secretary for Cuba and Venezuela, Carrie Filippetti.
While the Venezuelan people have suffered from a lack of access to basic food and medical care, the Maduro regime has used the money it does have not to support them, but to pay back bad loans to bad people. They're paying Russia for military support and equipment instead of buying food for the Venezuelan people. They're sending free oil and gasoline to Cuba, while the Venezuelan people stand in lines for hours simply with the hope of filling their gas tanks. And of course, they're prioritizing the delivery of surveillance equipment from China over delivery of much-needed humanitarian supplies.
These and other egregious abuses by the Maduro regime, including what a recent UN Human Rights Council report called shockingly high rates of extrajudicial killings by security forces, have caused 4.4 million Venezuelans, some 15% of the country's population, to flee the country. That is why the United States and 55 other countries recognize interim President Juan Guaido and the Venezuelan National Assembly as the legitimate leaders of Venezuela. This is a critical period for the people of Venezuela, and that's because while we have seen more of the same from the Maduro regime, more desperation, more brutality, more manipulation, we've seen powerful new successes for the democratic actors inside Venezuela, said Deputy Assistant Secretary Filippetti. The United States will continue to answer Interim President Guaido's call to help the people of Venezuela cope with severe food and medicine shortages. We'll continue our efforts to support the people of Venezuela during their humanitarian crisis.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.